Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Martin, reading The Runaway Skyscraper by Murray Leinster. Part 4. Arthur stood at the window of his office and stared out toward the west. The sun was setting, but upon what a scene! Where from this same window Arthur had seen the sun setting behind the Jersey hills, all edged with the angular roofs of factories, with their chimneys emitting columns of smoke. He now saw the same sun sinking redly behind a mass of luxuriant foliage. And where he was accustomed to look upon the tops of high buildings, each entitled to the name of skyscraper, he now saw miles and miles of waving green branches. The wide Hudson flowed on placidly, all unruffled by the arrival of this strange monument upon its shores. The same Hudson Arthur knew as a busy thoroughfare of puffing steamers and chugging launches. Two or three small streams wandered unconcernedly across the land that Arthur had known as the most closely built-up territory on Earth. And far, far below him, Arthur had to lean well out of his window to see it, stood a collection of tiny wigwams. These small bark structures represented the original metropolis of New York. His telephone rang. Van Deventer was on the wire. The exchange in the building was still working. Van Deventer wanted Arthur to come down to his private office. There were still a great many things to be settled. The arrangements for commandeering offices, for sleeping quarters for the women, and numberless other details. The men who seemed to have best kept their heads were gathering there to settle upon a course of action. Arthur glanced out of the window again before going to the elevator. He saw a curiously compact dark cloud moving swiftly across the sky to the west. "Miss Woodward," he said sharply, "what is that?" Estelle came to the window and looked. "They're birds," she told him, "birds flying in a group. I've often seen them like that in the country, though never as many as that." "How do you catch birds?" Arthur asked her. "I know about shooting them and so on, but we haven't guns enough to count. Could we catch them in traps, do you think?" "I wouldn't be surprised," said Estelle thoughtfully, "but it would be hard to catch many." "Come downstairs," directed Arthur. "You know as much as any of the men here, and more than most, apparently. We're going to make you show us how to catch things." Estelle smiled, a trifle wanly. Arthur led the way to the elevator. In the car, he noticed that she looked distressed. "What's the matter?" he asked. "You aren't really frightened, are you?"
"No," she answered shakily, "but I'm rather upset about this thing. It's so terrible somehow to be back here, thousands of miles or years away from all one's friends and everybody." "Please," Arthur smiled encouragingly at her, "please count me as your friend, won't you?" She nodded but blinked back some more tears. Arthur would have tried to hearten her further, but the elevator stopped at their floor. They walked into the room where the meeting of cool heads was to take place. No more than a dozen men were in there, talking earnestly but dispiritedly. When Arthur and Estelle entered, Van Deventer came over to greet them. "We've got to do something," he said in a low voice. "A wave of homesickness has swept over the whole place. Look at those men. Everyone is thinking about his family and contrasting his cozy fireside with all that wilderness outside." "You don't seem to be worried," Arthur observed with a smile. Van Deventer's eyes twinkled. "I'm a bachelor," he said cheerfully, and I live in a hotel. I've been longing for a chance to see some real excitement for 30 years. Business has kept me from it up to now, but I'm enjoying myself hugely."
Estelle looked at the group of dispirited men.
"We'll simply have to do something," she said with a shaky smile. "I feel just as they do. This morning I hated the thought of having to go back to my boarding house tonight, but right now I feel as if the odor of cabbage in the hallway would seem like heaven."
Arthur led the way to the flat-top desk in the middle of the room.
"Well, let's settle a few more of the important matters," he said in a businesslike tone. "None of us has any authority to act for the rest of the people in the tower, but so many of us are in a state of blue funk that those who are here must have charge for a while. Anybody? Any suggestions?"
"Housing," said Van Deventer promptly. "I suggest that we draft a gang of men to haul all the upholstered settees and rugs that are to be found to one floor for the women to sleep on."
Yes. That's a good idea. Anybody a better plan?"
No one spoke. They all still looked much too homesick to take any great interest in anything, but they began to listen more or less half-heartedly.
"I've been thinking about coal," said Arthur. "There's undoubtedly a supply in the basement, but I wonder if it wouldn't be well to cut the lights off most of the floors, only lighting up the ones we're using."
"That might be a good idea later," Estelle said quietly, "but light is cheering somehow, and everyone feels so blue that I wouldn't do it tonight. Tomorrow they'll begin to get up their resolution again, and you can ask them to do things."
"If we're going to starve to death," one of the other men said gloomily, "we might as well have plenty of light to do it by."
"We aren't going to starve to death," retorted Arthur sharply. "Just before I came down, I saw great clouds of birds, greater than I've ever seen before. When we get at those birds..."
"When?" echoed the gloomy one.
"They were pigeons," Estelle explained. "They shouldn't be hard to snare or trap."
"I usually have my dinner before now," the gloomy one protested, "and I'm told I won't get anything tonight."
The other men began to straighten their shoulders. The peevishness of one of their number seemed to bring out their latent courage.
"Well, we've got to stand it for the present," one of them said almost philosophically. "What I'm most anxious about is getting back. Have we any chance?"
Arthur nodded emphatically.
"I think so. I have a sort of idea as to the cause of our sinking into the fourth dimension, and when that is verified, a corrective can be looked for and applied."
"How long will that take?"
"Can't say," Arthur replied frankly. "I don't know what tools, what materials, or what workmen we have, and what's rather more to the point, I don't even know what work will have to be done. The pressing problem is food."
"Oh, bother the food," someone protested impatiently. "I don't care about myself. I can go hungry tonight. I want to get back to my family."
"That's all that really matters," a chorus of voices echoed.
"We'd better not bother about anything else until we find we can't get back."
"Concentrate on getting back," one man stated more explicitly.
"Look here," said Arthur incisively. "You've a family, and so have a great many of the others in the tower. But your family and everybody else's family has got to wait. As an inside limit, we can hope to begin work on the problem of getting back when we're sure there's nothing else going to happen. I tell you quite honestly that I think I know what is the direct cause of this catastrophe, and I'll tell you even more honestly that I think I'm the only man among us who can put this tower back where it started from. And I'll tell you most honestly of all that any attempt to meddle at this present time with the forces that led us down here will result in a catastrophe considerably greater than the one that happened today."
"Well, if you're sure..." someone began reluctantly. "I am so sure that I'm going to keep to myself.
the knowledge of what will start those forces to work again. Arthur said quietly, I don't want any impatient meddling, if we start them too soon. God only knows what will happen.
Van Deventer was eyeing Arthur Chamberlain keenly.
It isn't a question of your wanting pay in exchange for your services in putting us back, is it? He asked coolly.
Arthur turned and faced him. His face began to flush slowly.
Van Deventer put up one hand. I beg your pardon. I see.
We aren't settling the things we came here for, Estelle interrupted. She had noticed the threat of friction and hastened to put it in a diversion. Arthur relaxed.
I think that, as a beginning, he suggested, we'd better get sleeping arrangements completed. We can get everybody together somewhere, I dare say, and then secure volunteers for the work.
Right. Van Deventer was anxious to make amends for his blunder of a moment before. Shall I send the bank watchman to go on each floor in turn and ask everybody to come downstairs?
You might start them, Arthur said. It will take a long time for everyone to assemble.
Van Deventer spoke into the telephone on his desk. In a moment, he hung up the receiver.
They're on their way, he said.
Arthur was frowning to himself and scribbling in a notebook.
Of course, he announced abstractedly, the pressing problem is food. We've caught a number of fishermen, a few hunters. We've got to have a lot of food at once and everything considered. I think we'd better count on the fishermen. At sunrise, we'd better have some people begin to dig bait and wake our anglers. They'd better make their tackle tonight, don't you think?
There was a general nod. We'll announce that, then. The fishermen will go to the river under guard of the men we have who can shoot. I think what Indians there are will be much too frightened to try to ambush any of us, but we'd better be on the safe side. They'll keep together and fish at nearly the same spot, with our hunters patrolling the woods behind them, taking pot shots at game if they see any. The fishermen should make more or less of a success, I think. The Indians weren't extensive fishers that I ever heard of, and the river ought to fairly swarm with fish.
He closed his notebook.
How many weapons can we count on altogether? Arthur asked Van Deventer.
In the bank, about a dozen riot guns and half a dozen repeating rifles. Everywhere else, I don't know. 40 or 50 men said they had revolvers, though.
We'll give revolvers to the men who go with the fishermen. The Indians haven't heard firearms and will run at the report, even if they dare attack our men. We can send out the gun-armed men as hunters, someone suggested, and send gardeners with them to look for vegetables and such things.
And we'll have to take a sort of census, really, Arthur suggested, finding out what everyone can do and getting him to do it.
I never planned anything like this before, Van Deventer remarked, and I never thought I should. But this is much more fun than running a bank.
Arthur smiled.
Let's go and have our meeting, he said cheerfully.
But the meeting was a gloomy and despairing affair.
Nearly everyone had watched the sun set upon a strange, wild landscape. Hardly an individual among the whole 2,000 of them had ever been out of sight of a house before in his or her life. To look out at a vast, untouched wilderness, where hitherto they had seen the most highly civilized city on the globe, would have been startling and depressing enough in itself. But to know that they were alone in a whole continent of savages, and that there was not indeed in all the world a single community of people they could greet as brothers, was terrifying. Few of them thought so far, but there was actually, if Arthur's estimate of several thousand years dropped back through time was correct, there was actually no other group of English-speaking people in the world. The English language was yet to be invented. Even Rome, the synonym for antiquity of culture, might still be an obscure village
inhabited by a band of tatterdemalions under the leadership of an upstart Romulus. Soft in body as these people were, city-bred and unaccustomed to face other than the most conventionalized emergencies of life, they were terrified. Hardly one of them had even gone without a meal in all his life. To have the prospect of having to earn their food, not by manipulation of figures in a book or by expert juggling of profits and prices, but by literal wrestling of that food from its source in the earth or stream, was really a terrifying thing for them. In addition, every one of them was bound to the life of modern times by 100 ties. Many of them had families 1,000 years away. All had interests, engrossing interests, in modern New York. One young man felt an anxiety that was really ludicrous, because he had promised to take his sweetheart to the theater that night, and if he did not come, she would be very angry. Another was have to have been married in a week. Some of the people were, like Van Deventer and Arthur, so situated that they could view the episode as an adventure, or like Estelle, who had no immediate fear, because all her family was provided for without her help and lived far from New York, so they would not learn of the catastrophe for some time. Many, however, felt instant and pressing fear for the families whose expenses ran always so close to their incomes that the disappearance of the breadwinner for a week would mean actual want or debt. There are very many such families in New York. The people, therefore, that gathered hopelessly at the call of Van Deventer's watchmen were dazed and spiritless. Their excitement, after Arthur's first attempt to explain the situation to them, had evaporated. They were no longer keyed up to a high pitch by the startling thing that had happened to them. Nevertheless, although only half comprehending what had actually occurred, they began to realize what that occurrence meant. No matter where they might go over the whole face of the globe, they would always be aliens and strangers. If they had been carried away to an unknown shore, some wilderness far from their own land, they might have thought of building ships to return to their homes. They had seen New York vanish before their eyes, however. They had seen civilization disappear while they watched. They were in a barbarous world. There was not, for example, a single sulfur match on the whole earth except those in the runaway skyscraper. Please join me next time for another exciting chapter of The Runaway Skyscraper by Murray Leinster, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Meanwhile, watch the skies. Thank you.